disappear. Later, Ali and Tatiana Moskalev eat a late supper. Even with the war, even with the fighting on the northern front with the Moldovan troops and the standoff in the east with Russia herself, even still, the food is pretty good. President Moskalev of Besapara lays on roast pheasant and Hasselback potatoes with sweet cabbage for Mother Eve of the new church, and they toast each other in good red wine.
We need a first victory, says Tatiana.
Ali chews slowly and thoughtfully.
Can you have a first victory 3 years into a war?
Tatiana laughs.
The real war hasn't even begun yet. They're still fighting with conventional weapons up there in the hills. They try to invade, we push them back. They throw grenades, we shoot.
Electrical power's no use against missiles and bombs. Tatiana sits back, crosses one leg over the other, looks at her.
Do you think so?
She frowns, amused.
For one, wars aren't won by bombs. They're won on the ground. And for two, have you seen what a full dose of that drug can do?
Ali has seen it. Roxy showed her. It's hard to control. Ali wouldn't want to take it. Control has always been her speciality. But a full dose of the glitter, and 3 or 4 women could take down the electricity of the island of Manhattan. You still have to be near enough to touch them. Make a connection?
There are ways to arrange that. We've seen photographs of them working on it themselves.
Ah, says the voice. She's talking about that exiled king of Saudi Arabia.
Awadi Atif, says Ali. He's just using our country as a trial, you know.
Tatiana swallows down another gulp of wine.
They're sending in some of their men in rubber suits with their stupid battery packs on their backs. He wants to show that the change means nothing. He still holds to his old religion, and he thinks he's getting his country back.
Tatiana makes a long arc between her left palm and her right, spools it out idly, winds it back and breaks it with a snap.
The hairdresser, she says with a smile, didn't know what she was starting.
She looks directly at Ali, a sudden, intense stare.
Awadi Atif thinks he's been sent on a holy war, and I think he's right. I was chosen by God for this.
She wants you to tell her she was, says the voice. Tell her.
You were, says Ali.
God has a special mission for you.
I have always believed there was something greater than me, something better. And when I saw you, the force in the way you speak to the people, I see that you are her messenger, and you and I have met at this time for this reason, to bring this message to the world.
The voice says, didn't I tell you I had some things in store for you? Ali says, so when you say you want a fast victory, you mean that when Awadi Atif sends down his electric troops, you want to destroy them utterly?
Tatiana waves a hand. I have chemical weapons left over from Cold War. If I wanted to destroy them utterly, I could do it. No.
She leans forward.
I want to humiliate them. Show that this mechanical power cannot compare with what we have in our bodies.
The voice says, do you see it? And Ali does see it, suddenly and all at once. Awadi Atif of Saudi Arabia has armed the troops in North Moldova. They plan to retake Besapara, the Republic of the Women. For them, this would show that this change is merely a minor deviation from the norm, that the right way will reassert itself. And if they lose, and lose utterly. Ali begins to smile. The Holy Mother's Way will spread across the world, from person to person, from country to country. The thing will be over before it's begun. Tatiana raises her glass for a toast.
I knew you would see it when we invited you here. I hoped you would understand what I mean. The world is watching this war.
She wants you to bless her war, says the voice. Tricky. Tricky if she loses, says Allie in her heart. I thought you wanted to be safe, says the voice. You told me I couldn't be safe unless I owned the place, says Allie in her heart. And I told you that you couldn't get there from here, says the voice. Whose side are you on anyway? Says Allie. Mother Eve speaks slowly and carefully. Mother Eve measures her words. Nothing that Mother Eve says is without consequence. She looks directly into the camera and waits for the red light to flash on. We don't have to ask ourselves what the Saudi royal family will do if they win this war, she says. We've already seen it. We know what happened in Saudi Arabia for decades, and we know that God turned her face from it in horror and disgust. We don't have to ask ourselves who is on the side of justice when we meet the brave fighters of Bessapara, many of whom were trafficked women, shackled women, women who would have died alone in the dark if God had not sent her light to guide them. This country, she says, is God's country. And this war is God's war. With her help, we shall have a mighty victory. With her help, everything will be overturned. The red light blinks off. The message goes out across the world. Mother Eve and her millions of loyal followers on YouTube and Instagram, on Facebook and Twitter, her donors and her friends, are with Bessapara and the Republic of the Women. They've made their choice. Margot. I'm not saying you have to break up with him.
Mom, that is what you're saying.
I'm just saying, read the reports. See for yourself.
If you're giving them to me, I already know what's in them.
Just read them. Margot gestures to the pile of papers on the coffee table. Bobby did not want to have this conversation. Maddie's out at taekwondo practice, so it's up to her, of course. Bobby's exact words had been, "It's your political career you're worried about, so you handle it."
"Whatever those papers say, Mom, Ryan's a good person. He's a kind person. He's good to me."
"He's been on extremist sites, Joss. He posts under a false name on sites that talk about organizing terror attacks. They have links with some of those groups."
Jocelyn is crying now, frustrated, angry tears.
"He'd never do that. He probably just wanted to see what they're saying, Mom. We met online. We both go to some crazy sites."
Margot picks up one of the pages at random, reads out the highlighted section. "Buck you, nice name he's picked there, says, "Things have gotten out of hand. Those North Star camps, for one thing. If people knew what they were learning there, we'd put a bullet in every girl in the place."
She pauses, looks at Jocelyn.
Joss says, "How do they even know that's him?"
Margot waves at the thick file of documents.
"Oh, I don't know. They have their ways."
This is the tricky part. Margot holds her breath. Will Joss buy it? Joss looks at her, lets out one quick sob.
"The Department of Defense is vetting you, isn't it? Because you're going to be a senator, and they want you on the defense committee like you told me?"
Hook, line, and sinker.
"Yes, Jocelyn. That is why the FBI found this stuff. Because I have an important job, and I'm not going to apologize for that."
She pauses.
"I thought we were in this together, honey. and you need to know that this Ryan's not what you think.
He was just trying something out, probably. Those are things from 3 years ago. We all say stupid stuff online, okay? Just to get a reaction.
Margot sighs. I don't know if we can be sure of that, honey.
I'll talk to him. He's...
Joss starts crying again. Loud, long, deep sobs. Margot scoots towards her on the couch, puts a tentative arm around Joss's shoulders. Joss sinks into her, burying her face in Margot's chest and crying, just like she did when she was a child.
There'll be other boys, honey. There'll be other better boys.
Joss lifts her face.
I thought we were supposed to be together. I know, sweetheart, because of your...
Margot hesitates over the word.
Because of your problem. You wanted someone who'd understand.
She wishes they'd been able to find help for Joss. They're still looking. But the older she gets, the more intractable the problem seems to be. Sometimes she has all the power she wants, and sometimes nothing. Joss's sobs slow to a trickle. Margot brings her a cup of tea, and they sit in silence for a while on the couch, Margot's arm around Joss. After a long while, Margot says,
I still think we can find some help for you. If we could find someone to help you, well, you'd just be able to like normal boys.
Joss puts her cup down on the table slowly. She says,
Do you really think so?
And Margot says,
I know it, honey, I know it. You can be just like all the other girls. I know we can fix it for you.
This is what it means to be a good mother. Sometimes you can see what your kids need better than they can. Roxy. Come home, says the message. Ricky's been hurt. She's supposed to be going to Moldova. Supposed to be training women in how to use the glitter to fight. But she can't. Not with a message like that on her phone. She stayed out of Ricky's way, mostly, since she got back from America. She's got her own thing with the glitter, and it's making them good money. Roxy used to long to be invited into that house. Bernie's given her a key now. She's got a guest bedroom for when she's not out at the Black Sea. But it's not what she thought it'd be. Barbara, the mother of the three boys, hasn't been right since Terry died. There's a big photo of Terry on the mantelpiece, with fresh flowers in front of it, changed every 3 days. Darryl's still living there. He's taken on the betting, because he's got the brain for it. Ricky's got his own place up in Canary Wharf. Roxy thinks, when she reads that text, of the different firms that could have it in for them, and what hurt means. If it's war, they need her home for sure. But it's Barbara who's waiting for her in the front garden when she gets there, smoking non-stop, lighting the next one from the embers of the last. Bernie's not even home. So it's not war. It's something else. Barbara says, Ricky's been hurt. Roxy says, knowing the answer,
Was it one of the other firms? That Romanian lot?
Barbara shakes her head. She says, They fucked him up for fun. Roxy says,
Dad knows people. You didn't need to call me.
Barbara's hands are shaking. No, it's not for them. It's a family thing. So Roxy knows exactly what kind of thing has happened to Ricky. Ricky's got the TV on, but the sound's off. There's a blanket over his knees and bandages under that. Doctor's been and gone, so there's nothing to see, anyway. Roxy's got girls working for her, who were held by blokes in Moldova. She saw what one of them had done to the three men who'd taken turns with her. Down there, it was just burned flesh. Fern patterns on the thighs, pink and brown and raw red and black, like a Sunday roast. Ricky doesn't seem that bad. He'll probably be fine. This kind of thing heals. She's heard that things can be difficult afterwards, though. It can be hard to get over. She says, Just tell me what happened. Ricky looks at her, and he's grateful. And his gratitude is terrible. She wants to hug him, but she knows that'd just make it worse for him somehow. You can't be the one that hurts and the one that comforts. She can't give Ricky anything but justice. He tells her what happened. He was pissed, obviously. Out with some mates, dancing. He's got a couple of girlfriends, Ricky, but he never minds finding someone new for the night. And the girls know not to bother him about it. That's just how he is. Roxy's the same these days. Sometimes there's a bloke and sometimes there isn't, and it doesn't matter much to her either way. This time, Ricky got three girls, said they were sisters, but they didn't look like sisters. He thinks it was a joke. One of them sucked him off by the kitchen bins outside the club. Whatever she did, it made his head spin. He looks ashamed when he says it, like he thinks he should have done something different. When she was finished, the others were waiting, and he went, "Give me a minute, girls. Can't do you all at once." And they were on him. There's a thing you can do to a bloke. Roxy's done it herself. A little bit of a spark in the back passage, and up he comes, neat as anything. It's fun, if you want it. Hurts a bit, but fun. Hurts a lot if you don't want it. Ricky kept on saying he didn't want it. They took their turns on him. They were just trying to hurt him, he says, and he was saying, did they want money? What did they want? But one of them got him in the throat, and he couldn't make another sound until they were finished. The whole thing took half an hour. Ricky thought he might die there, in between the black bags and the thick grease coating the paving stones. He could see them finding his body, white legs marked with red scars. He could see a copper turning out his pockets and saying, "You'll never guess who this is, only Ricky Monk." And his face fish white and his lips blue. Ricky kept very still until it was over, and didn't say nothing and didn't do nothing, just waited for it to be done. Roxy knows why they haven't called Bernie home. He'd hate Ricky for this, even if he tried not to. This is not what happens to a man. Except now, it is. The stupid thing is that he does know them. The more he thinks about it, the more he's sure. He's seen them around. He doesn't think they know who he is. You'd think they'd have been scared otherwise to do what they did. But he knows people he's seen with them. One of them's called Manda, he's pretty sure. One of them's Sam. Roxy gets an idea. Looks at a couple of people on Facebook. Shows him some photos until he starts to shake. It's not hard to find them. It doesn't take Roxy more than 5 phone calls to someone who knows someone who knows someone. She doesn't say why she's asking, but she doesn't need to. She's Roxy Monk and people want to help her. They're drinking in a pub in Vauxhall. They're tanked up. They're laughing. They'll be here till closing. Roxy's got some good girls here in London now. Girls who run the business for her and collect the profits and knock the heads together that need knocking. It's not that a bloke couldn't do the job. Some of them would do it handy. But it's better if they don't need a gun. They're noisy, draw attention, they're messy. Quick Barney ends up with a double murder and 30 years in prison. For a job like this, you take girls. Except when she gets dressed and comes downstairs, there's Daryl waiting by the front door. He's got a sawn-off on his arm. "What?" says Roxy. "I'm coming," says Daryl. She thinks for a moment of saying, "Sure," and knocking him cold when he turns away. But after what's happened to Ricky, it wouldn't be right. "You keep yourself safe," she says. "Yeah," he goes. "I'll stick behind you." He's younger than her, only by a few months. That's one of the things that's always been so hard, Bernie knocking up both their mums at the same time. She grabs his shoulder and squeezes it. She calls another couple of lasses to come too. Vivica, with one of those long, pronged conductive battens, and Danny, with a mesh of metal net that she likes. They all take a little bit before they head out the door, and there's music playing in Roxy's head. Sometimes it's good to go to war. Just to know you can. They follow that little knot of girls from the pub at a bit of a distance till they walk through the park, shouting and drinking. It's past 1 a.m. It's a hot night. The air feels damp, like there's a storm brewing. Roxy and her gang are dressed dark. They're moving smoothly. The girls run towards the merry-go-round in the kids' playground. They lie back on it, staring at the stars, passing the vodka between them. Roxy says, "Now." Merry-go-round's made of steel. They light the thing up, and one of the girls falls off, frothing and twitching. So now they're 2-on-4. Easy. "What's this?" says a girl in a dark blue bomber jacket. Ricky had pointed her photo out as the leader. "What the fuck is this? I don't even know you!" She makes a bright warning arc between her palms.
"Yeah,"
says Roxy. "You bloody knew my brother, though. Ricky. Picked him up in a club last night. Ricky Monk."
"Oh, fuck,"
says the other girl, the one wearing leathers.
"Shut up,"
says the first girl.
"We don't know your fucking brother, all right?"
"Sam,"
says the girl in leathers.
"Fuck's sake."
She turns to Roxy, pleading.
"We didn't know he was your brother. He never said nothing."
Sam mutters something that sounds like, "He bloody loved it." The girl in leathers puts her hands up and takes a pace backwards. Daryl gets her square in the back of the head with the butt of the shotgun. She falls forward, teeth into the soil and scrub. So now they're 4-1. Closing in. Danny sifts a little mesh net in her left hand. Sam says,
"He was asking for it. He begged us for it. Fucking begged us, followed us, told us what he wanted done to him, filthy little scrote. Knew just what he was looking for, couldn't get enough of it, wanted us to hurt him. Would have licked up my piss if I'd asked him. That's your fucking brother. Looks like butter wouldn't melt, but he's a dirty little boy."
Yeah, well, might be true. Might not. Roxy's seen some things. She still shouldn't have touched a monk, should she? She'll ask Ricky's mates about it quietly when all this is over, and maybe she'll have to tell him not to be a stupid boy. If he wants that kind of thing, she can find someone safe to oblige.
"Don't you talk about my fucking brother like that!"
Daryl yells suddenly, and he's aiming the shotgun butt for her face, but she's too quick for him, and it's metal, that shotgun. So when she grabs it, he gasps and his knees buckle. Sam gets one arm around Daryl, his whole body shuddering. It was a big jolt she gave him. His eyes are rolling back in his head. Fuck! If they hit her, they hit him.
Fuck!
Sam starts to back away.
"Don't you bloody follow me,"
she says.
"Don't you bloody come near me or I'll finish him like I did your Ricky. I can do worse than that."
Daryl's close to tears now. Roxy can tell what she's doing to him. A constant pulse of shocks into the neck, the throat, the temples. It's most painful at the temples. "This isn't over," Roxy says quietly. "You can get away now, but we'll come back for you until it's done." Sam smiles, all white teeth and blood.
"Maybe I'll do him now then, for fun."
"That's not clever," says Roxy, "'cause then we really would have to kill you." She gives the nod to Viv, who circled back round during the commotion. Viv swings her baton. She gives a whack to the back of Sam's head, like a sledgehammer taking out dry wall. Sam turns slightly, sees it coming, but she can't put Daryl down in time to duck. The baton catches the side of her eye, and there's a burst of blood. She screams out once and falls to the floor.
"Fuck!"
says Daryl. He's crying and shaking. There's not much they can do about that.
"If she'd seen what you were doing, she'd have killed me!"
"You're alive, aren't you?" says Roxy. She doesn't say anything about how he shouldn't have gone for Sam with the shotgun, and she thinks that's fair enough. Roxy takes her time in marking them. Don't want them to forget it. Not ever. Ricky won't be able to forget it. She leaves them with a spider web of red, unfolding scars over their cheeks and mouth and nose. She takes a photo with her phone, so Ricky can see what she's done. The scars and the blind eye. Only Barbara's awake when they get in. Daryl goes to bed, but Roxy sits at the little table in the back kitchen, and Barbara flicks through the photos on the phone, nodding with a mouth like a stone. "All still alive," she says. "Even called 999 for 'em." Barbara says, "Thank you, Roxanne. I'm grateful. You've done a good thing here. Roxy says,
Yep.
The clock ticks. Barbara says, I'm sorry we were unkind to you. Roxy raises an eyebrow.
I wouldn't say the word for it was unkind, Barbara.
Which is harsher than she meant. But there's a lot happened when she was a kid. Those parties she couldn't come to, and the presents she never got, and the family dinner she was never invited to, and that time that Barbara came round to the house and threw paint at the windows. You didn't need to do this tonight for Ricky. I didn't think you would.
Some of us don't hold grudges. All right.
Barbara looks like she'd slapped her in the face.
It's all right, says Roxy,
because it is now. It's been all right maybe since Terry died. She chews her lip a bit.
You never liked me because of whose daughter I was. I never expected you would like me. It's all right. We stay out of each other's way, don't we?
It's just business.
She stretches, her skein tautening across her chest, her muscles suddenly heavy and tired.
Barbara looks at her, eyes slightly narrowed. There's stuff Ma Byrne still hasn't told you, you know. About how the business runs. Don't know why.
He was saving it for Ricky, says Roxy.
Yeah, says Barbara. I think he was. But Ricky's not going to take it now.
She stands up, goes over to the kitchen cupboard. From the third shelf, she takes out the bags of flour and the boxes of biscuits. And there, right at the back, she sticks her nail into an almost invisible crack and opens up a hidden cubbyhole, not wider than your hand. She pulls out three small black notebooks held together by an elastic band.
Contacts, she says. Narx, bent coppers, rotten doctors. I've been saying for months Byrne should just give this all to you, so you could work out how to sell the glitter yourself.
Roxy holds out her hand, takes the books, feels the weight and solidity of them in her palm. All the knowledge of how the business is run in a compact block, a brick of information.
Because of what you did today, says Barbara, for Ricky, I'll square it with Bernie.
And she takes her mug of tea and goes to bed. Roxy stays up the rest of that night back at her own place, going through the books, making notes and plans. There are contacts here go back years. Connections her dad's been developing, people he's been blackmailing or bribing. And the latter usually leads to the former eventually. Barbara doesn't know what she's given her here. With the stuff in these books, she can take the glitter across Europe, no bother. The monks can make more money than anyone's made since Prohibition. She's smiling, and her one knee's joggling up and down when she runs her eye along a row of names and sees something important. It takes her a bit to work out what it is she's seen. Some bit of her brain got there ahead of all the rest, told her to read and reread the list till it jumped out at her. There. A name. A bent copper. Detective Newland. Newland. 'Cause she'll never forget that thing Primrose said when he died, will she? She'll never forget any of what happened that day her whole life long. Newland said, you weren't going to be home, Primrose had said. This copper. This Newland. He was part of the plan to kill her mum, and she's never known who he was, not till now. She thought it was done a long time since. But when she sees the name, and she remembers, she thinks, fuck! Some dodgy copper selling stuff to my dad, selling stuff to Primrose, fuck! She thinks, some dodgy copper watching our house and saying when I wouldn't be home. A quick search of the internet is all it takes. Detective Newland lives in Spain now, retired policeman, little town. Doesn't think anyone's going to come looking for him, obviously. She never meant to tell Daryl about it. It was only that he came himself to thank her for what she'd done for Ricky and for saving his own life. He said, we know which way this is going.
Ricky's out of the picture now. If there's anything I can do to help you, Rox, just tell me what I can do. Maybe he started to have the same thought she has, about how you just have to accept this change that struck us all, roll with it, find your place in it. So she told Daryl what she was going to Spain for. He said, I'm coming too. She sees what he's asking her for. Ricky's not coming back to the life. Not for years, maybe not ever, and not how he was. They're running out of family. He wants to be family to her. The place isn't difficult to find. GPS and a rental car, and they're there in less than an hour from Seville Airport. There's no need to be clever about it. They watch through binoculars for a couple of days, long enough to know that he lives alone. They stay in a hotel nearby, but not too nearby. 30 miles drive. You wouldn't go looking there if you were local police. Not if you were doing a routine just-in-case inquiry. He's nice with it, Daryl. Businesslike, but funny. Lets her make the decisions, but he's got a few good ideas of his own. She thinks, yeah. If Ricky's out of the game, yeah. This could work. She could take him to the factory next time she goes out. On the third day, in the pre-dawn light, they chuck a rope up one of the fence poles, climb over and wait in the bushes till he comes out. He's in shorts and a ragged T-shirt. He's got a sandwich. This time in the morning, a sausage sandwich. And he's looking at his phone. She'd been expecting something. Some kind of terror to strike her. She'd thought she might wee herself, or have a rush of bloody rage, or start crying. But when she looks into his face, all she feels is interest. A completed circle. Two bits of string tied together. The man who helped get her mum killed. This last little bit of stuff to mop up from the side of the plate. She steps out of the bushes in front of him. Newland, she says. Your name is Newland. He looks at her, open-mouthed. He's still holding his sausage sandwich. There's a second before the fear kicks in. And in that second, Daryl charges from the bushes, clonks him on the head, and pushes him into the swimming pool. When he comes round, the sun is high in the sky, and he's floating face up. He thrashes around, brings himself to standing in the middle of the pool, coughing and rubbing his eyes. Roxy's sitting at the edge, fingers splashing. Electricity travels a long way in water, she says. It's fast. Newland stands stock still at that. She tips her head first to one side, then the other, stretching out the muscles. Her skein's full. Newland starts to say something. Maybe it's, I don't, or who are? But she sends a little thrill through the water, enough to prickle him over his whole wet body. She says, this is going to be boring if you start denying everything, Detective Newland. Fuck, he says, I don't even know who you are. If this is about Lisa, she got her fucking money, all right. She got it 2 years ago, every penny, and I'm out now. Roxy sends another shot through the water. Think again, she says. Look at my face. Don't I remind you of anyone? Aren't I someone's daughter? He knows it then. All at once. She can see it in his face. Fuck, he says. It's about Christina. Yeah, she says. Please, he says. And then she sends him a hard jolt. So much that his teeth start chattering and his body goes rigid. And he shits himself right into the water, a brown-yellow cloud of particles jetting out like it's shot from a hose. Rox, says Daryl softly. He's sitting behind her, on one of the sun loungers, his hand on the butt of the rifle. She stops it. Newland collapses, sobbing into the water. Don't say please, she says. That's what my mum said. He rubs his forearms, trying to get some life back into them. There's no way out of this for you, Newland,
You told Primrose where to find my mum. You got her killed, and I'm going to kill you. Newland tries to make a break for the edge of the pool. She shocks him again. His knees collapse under him, and he falls forward, and then he's just lying there, face down in the water. "Fuck's sake," says Roxy. Daryl gets the hook and pulls him to the edge, and they haul him up. When Newland opens his eyes again, Roxy's sitting on his chest. "You're gonna die here now, Newland," says Daryl, very calmly. "This is it, mate. This is all the life you got. This is your last day, and there's nothing you can tell us that'll make it different, all right? But if we make it look like an accident, your life insurance will still pay out. To your mum, yeah, and your brother. We can do that for you. Make it look like an accident, not a suicide. All right." Newland coughs up a lungful of murky water.
"You got my mum killed, Newland," says Roxy. "That's strike one. And you've made me sit in your shitty water. That's strike two. If we get to strike three, there will be pain you just can't believe. I only want to know one thing from you."
He's listening to her now.
"What did Primrose give you, Newland, to tip him off about my mum? What would have made you bring the monks down on you? What seemed worth that to you, Newland?"
He blinks at them, first at her, then at Daryl, like they're having a laugh with him. She holds his face in her hand and sends a pickaxe of pain along his jaw. He screams.
"Just tell me, Newland," she says.
He's panting.
"You know, don't you?"
he says.
"You're kidding me."
She brings her hand close to his face.
"No,"
he says.
"No, no. You know what happened, you fucking bitch. It was your dad. It was never Primrose who plagued me. It was Bernie. Bernie Monk told me to do it. I only ever worked for Bernie. Only ever did jobs for Bernie. It was Bernie who told me that I should pretend to sell Primrose information. Tell him when to find your mum alone. You was never supposed to see it. Bernie wanted your mum dead, and I don't ask questions. I helped him out. It was fucking Bernie! Your dad! Bernie!"
He keeps on muttering the name, like it's the secret that will make her set him free. They don't get much more from him. He knew Roxy's mum was Bernie's woman. Yeah, of course he did. They told him that she'd cheated on Bernie, and that was enough to get her killed. Well, it would be. When they're finished, they tip him back in the pool, and she lights it up, just the once. It'll look like he had a heart attack, fell in, shat himself, and drowned. So they kept their promise. They change their clothes and take the rental car back to the airport. They haven't even left a hole in the fence. On the plane, Roxy says, "What now?" And Daryl says, "What you want, Rox?" She sits there for a bit, feeling the power in her, crystalline and complete. It felt like something, killing Newland, to see him go rigid and then stop. She thinks about what Eve said to her, that she knew Roxy was coming, that she's seen her destiny, that she's the one who's going to bring in the new world, that the power will be in her hands to change everything. She feels the power in her fingertips, as if she could punch a hole right through the world.
"I want justice," she says, "and then I want everything. You want to stand with me, or you want to stand against me?"
Bernie's in his office, looking through his books when they get there. He looks old to her. He hasn't shaved properly. There's tufts sticking out of his neck and his chin. There's a smell on him these days, too. Smells like hard cheese. She never thought before that he's old. They're his youngest ones. Ricky's 35. He knew they were coming. Barbara must have told him she'd given Roxy the notebooks. He smiles when they walk in the door. Daryl's behind her, holding a loaded gun. "You've got to understand, Rox," says Bernie. "I loved your mum. She never loved me. I don't think so. She was just using me for what she could get.
That why you killed her?
He inhales through his nose, like it surprises him to hear it, even so. I'm not gonna beg, he says. He's looking at Roxy's hands, at her fingers. I know how this goes, and I'll take it. But you've got to understand it wasn't personal. It was business. It was family, Dad, says Daryl very softly. Family's always personal. That's the truth, he says. But she got Al and Big Mick caught, he says. The Romanians paid her, and she told where they'd be. I cried when they told me it was her love I did, but I couldn't let it stand, could I? There's no one. You've got to understand. There's no one I could have let do that to me.
Roxy's made that kind of calculation herself, more than once.
You weren't supposed to see it, love.
Aren't you ashamed, Dad? Says Roxy.
He sticks his chin out, puts his tongue between his teeth and his bottom lip.
I'm sorry it happened. I'm sorry that's the way it went. I didn't mean for you to see it, and I've always looked after you. You're my girl.
He pauses.
Your mum hurt me more than I could tell you.
He breathes out through his nose again, heavy like a bull.
It's a bloody great tragedy, love. Even if I'd known all this was going to happen, I'd still have done it. I can't deny it, and if you're going to kill me, there's some justice to it, love.
He sits there, waiting for it, calm as anything. He must have thought about this 100 times, wondering who'd get him in the end. A friend or an enemy, or a growing mass in the center of the stomach, or if he'd make it all the way to a good old age. He must have thought before that it might be her, and that's why he's so calm with it now. She knows how this goes. If she kills him, it'll never be over. That's how it went with Primrose, how they ended up in a blood feud with him. If she keeps on killing anyone who pisses her off, someone will come for her in the end.
You know what's justice, Dad? She says. I want you to fuck off, and I want you to tell all of them that you're handing the business over to me. We're not having any bloody battles. No one else is coming up to take it from me. No one revenging you. No Greek tragedy. We're doing it peaceful. You're retiring. I'll protect you, and you'll fuck off. We'll fix you up with a safe place. Go somewhere with a beach.
Bernie nods.
You always was a clever girl, he says.
Jocelyn. They've had death threats and bomb scares at the North Star camp before, but never a real attack. Not till tonight. Jocelyn's on night watch. There are 5 of them, scanning the perimeter with binoculars. If you do your extras and you sleep over and you agree that you'll work for them for 2 years after you leave college, they'll pay your tuition. Pretty sweet deal. Margot could have paid for Jocelyn's college, but it looks good that she's doing it the same way the other girls do. Maddie's Skane has come in sure and strong, with none of Jocelyn's problems. She's only 15, and she's already talking about joining the elite cadets. 2 military daughters. That's how you run for president. Jocelyn's half-dozing at her watch station when the alarm sounds in the booth. Alarms have sounded before. It's been a fox or a coyote or sometimes a couple of drunk teenagers trying to climb over the fence on a dare. Jocelyn was once scared out of her wits by a shrieking in the trash at the back of the mess hall, only for 2 enormous raccoons to dive out of the metal bins, biting and running at each other. The others had laughed at her for her fright at that, as they laugh at her quite often. At first, there was Ryan, and that was exciting and fun and intense, and because his skein was just their secret, it made everything special. But then it got out somehow. Photos on a long lens, reporters at the door again, and the other girls at camp read about it. And then there were little whispered giggly conversations that fell silent when she walked into the room. She's read articles by women who wish they couldn't do it, and men who wish they could, and everything seems so confusing,
and all she really wants is to be normal. She broke up with Ryan, and he cried. And she found her face was dry like there was a stopper inside holding it all in. Her mom took her to a doctor privately, and they gave her something to feel more normal. And she does, in a way. She and three of the other girls on watch take up their nightsticks, long batons with sharp, whippy metal strands at the end, and go out into the night, expecting to find some local wildlife biting at the fence. Except, when they get there, there are three men, each carrying a baseball bat, their faces greased up with black. They're at the generator. One of them has a huge pair of bolt cutters. It's a terrorist incursion. Things happen quickly. Dakota, the eldest of them, whispers to Hayden, one of the youngest, to run for the North Star Guards. The others stay in a tight formation, bodies close together. There have been men at other camps with knives, guns, even grenades and homemade bombs. Dakota shouts out, "Put down your weapons!" The men's eyes are narrow and unreadable. They've come here to do something bad. Dakota swings her flashlight.
"All right, fellas," she says. "You've had your fun, but we caught you. Put them down."
One of them throws something. A gas grenade, smoke billowing out. The second uses his bolt cutters on an exposed tube in the generator. There's a bang. All the lights go out in the center of the camp. There's nothing now but the black sky, the stars, and these men who have come here to kill them. Jocelyn points her flashlight wildly around. One of the men is fighting with Dakota and Samara, swinging his baseball bat, shouting a tattered cry. The bat connects with Samara's head. There's blood. Fuck, there's blood. They've been trained. The girls are all trained. This isn't supposed to happen. Even with their power, can this still happen? Tegan's on him like a wolf, the power in her hands taking out one of his knees, but he kicks her square in the face, and what's that glinting under his jacket? What has he got? What the fuck has he got? Jocelyn runs for him. She'll hold him down and get whatever it is away from him. But as she goes, a hand grabs for her ankle, and she topples forward, face into the sandy earth. She scrambles onto all fours, crawling towards the flashlight, but before she can get there, it's picked up, pointed at her. She waits for the blow, but it's Dakota holding the light. Dakota with a bruise across her cheek, and Tegan next to her, and one of the men kneeling on the ground at Tegan's feet. She thinks it was the one she was fighting with. His balaclava's off. And he's young. Younger than she thought. Maybe only a year or two older than her. His lip is cut, and there's a fern-like scar unfurling across his jaw.
"Got him," says Dakota. "Fuck you," says the man. "We stand for freedom."
Tegan lifts up his head by his hair and jolts him again, just under the ear, a painful place.
"Who sent you here?" says Dakota,
but he doesn't answer.
"Joss," says Dakota. "Show him we mean business."
Jocelyn doesn't know where the other two women have gone.
"Shouldn't we wait?" she says. "For backup?"
Dakota says, "Goddamn bzzzt. You can't do it, can you?"
The boy's cowering on the floor. She doesn't need to do it. No one needs to do it now. Tegan says,
"Has he got a skein? She wants to fuck him."
The others laugh. "Yeah," they mutter. "That's what she likes. Weird men, deformed men, disgusting, strange, repulsive men. That's what she likes." If she fucking cries in front of them, they'll never forget it. Anyway, she's not what they think. She didn't even like it so much with Ryan, she didn't. She thought about it since they broke up, and she thinks the other girls are right. It's better with a man who can't do it. It's more normal anyway. She's been with a couple of other guys since, guys who liked it when she gave them a jolt, and even asked her for it in quiet voices close up to her ear, saying, "Please." It's better like that. And she wishes they'd just forget that Ryan ever existed. She's forgotten him. It was just a teenage thing, and the drugs have normalized her power more than ever. She's normal now. Completely normal. What would a normal girl do now? Dakota says,
"Fuck off, Cleary, I'll do it."
And Jocelyn says,
"No, you fuck off."
The boy on the floor whispers,
"Please."
Like they do. Jocelyn pushes Dakota out of the way and leans down and gives him a jolt in his head, just to teach him what he's got coming if he messes with them. She's emotional, though. Her trainers told her to watch out for that. There are surges going through her body. Hormones and electrolytes mess with everything. She can feel, as it leaves her body, that it's too much. She tries to hold it back, but it's too late. His scalp crisps under her hand. He screams. Inside his skull, liquid is cooking. Delicate parts are fusing and congealing. The lines of power are scarring him faster than thought. She can't hold it back. It's not a good way to go. She didn't mean to do it. There's a smell of burnt hair and flesh. Tegan says, "Fuck!" And there's an arc light on them suddenly. It's two of the North Star people. A man and a woman. Joss has met them before, Esther and Johnny. At last. They must have rigged up a light from a backup generator. Jocelyn's mind is working very quickly, even though her body is slow. Her hand is still on the boy's head. There's a faint wisp of smoke at her fingertips. Johnny says, "Jesus." Esther says, "Were there more?" The girl said there were three. Dakota's still staring at the boy. Jocelyn peels her fingers off him one by one, and she doesn't think about it at all. She has the sense that if she starts to think about it, she'll tumble down into the deep, dark water. There's a black ocean waiting for her now. It will always be waiting. She takes her fingers off, not thinking about it, and she pulls her sticky palm up, not thinking about it, and the body tumbles forward, face first, into the dirt. Esther says, "Johnny, go and get a fucking medic. Now." Johnny's staring at the body, too. He makes a little laugh and says, "Medic?" Esther says, "Now, go and get the fucking medic, Johnny." He swallows. His eyes flick to Jocelyn, Tegan, Esther. When he catches Esther's eye, he nods swiftly, backs up a few paces, turns and runs out of the circle of the arc light and into the dark. Esther looks round the circle. Dakota starts to say, "What happened was..." But Esther shakes her head. "Let's see," she says. She kneels down by the body, flips it over with one hand, rummages in his coat. They can't quite see what's happening. She finds some gum, a handful of flyers for a men's protest group. And then there's a familiar, heavy, metallic chink. Esther reaches behind him, and there in her palm is a gun, thick and snub-nosed, military issue. "He pulled a gun on you," says Esther. Jocelyn frowns. She understands, but she can't stop herself from saying the words, "No, he didn't, he was..." She stops as her mouth catches up to her brain. Esther speaks in a very calm and easy tone. There's a smile in her voice, like she's talking Joss through an equipment maintenance drill. "First turn off the power, then apply the lubricating fluid, then adjust the belt using the tightening screw. Simple. One thing, then the next. 1, 2, 3. This is how it has to go." She says, "You saw that he had a gun in the side pocket of his coat, and he was reaching for it. He had already committed an act of violence against us. You perceived a clear and present danger. You reached for the gun, and you used proportionate force to stop him." Esther uncurls the boy's fingers and wraps them around the holster of the pistol. "It's simpler to understand this way. He was holding his gun," she says. "He was about to fire it." She looks around the circle of young women, meeting each of their eyes in turn. Tegan says,
"Yeah, that's what happened. I saw him reach for his gun."
Jocelyn looks at the gun, clasped in the cooling fingers. Some of the North Star people carry their own unregistered sidearms. Her mom had to get the New York Times to pull a piece about it, on the grounds that it would threaten Homeland Security. Maybe he had that gun in his back pocket. Maybe he was going to turn it on them. But if they had guns, why were they using bats? Esther clasps her hand on Jocelyn's shoulder. "You're a hero, soldier," she says.
"Yes,"
says Jocelyn.
It gets easier to tell the story the more she does it. She starts to see it very clearly in her mind's eye, so that by the time she's talking about it on national TV, she thinks she half remembers it anyway. Hadn't she seen something metal in one of their pockets? Couldn't it have been a gun? Maybe that's why she let off her blast. Yes, she probably did know. She smiles on the television news. No, she says, I don't feel like a hero. Anyone would have done the same.
Oh, come on, says Kristen. I couldn't have done it. Could you, Matt?
Matt laughs and says,
I couldn't even have watched.
He's very attractive, a good 10 years younger than Kristen. The network had found him, just trying something out. While we're at it, Kristen, why don't you wear your glasses on screen now? It'll give you gravitas. We're going to see how the numbers play out this way. We're sending it for a run around the park, okay?
Well, your mom must be very proud, Jocelyn.
She is proud. She knows part of the story, but not the whole thing. It's given her leverage with the Defense Department in rolling out the North Star training camp scheme for girls across all 50 states. It's a well-run program, with good links to colleges, and they're able to charge the Army a bounty for every girl they send their way who can bypass basic and go straight into active duty. The Army is fond of Margot Cleary.
And with all that's going on in the news, says Matt, this war in Eastern Europe, what is that about? First the South Moldovans are winning, now it's the North Moldovans and the Saudis are involved somehow.
He shrugs helplessly.
It's great to know that we have young women like you ready to defend the country.
Oh, yes, says Jocelyn, just like she practiced. I would never have been able to do it at all without the training I received at North Star Camp.
Kristen squeezes her knee.
Will you stick around, Jocelyn? We're going to be tasting some great cinnamon recipes for fall after the break.
Of course.
Matt smiles into the camera.
I know I feel safer with you around. And now, the weather on the ones.
Audio guide for the Museum of Post-Cataclysm Artifacts. This case contains two precious objects from pre-cataclysm time which have been welded to cataclysm-era technology. The first is a metal figure of a victorious woman standing with one hand on her hip. The other arm is wreathed in bangles from elbow to armpit. She is welded to a metal base. The display text for this female figure reads, Statue of the Priestess Queen, found in a treasure trove in Lahore. The statue itself is substantially older than the base, which is made from repurposed cataclysm-era technology. Though it is much eroded, analysis of the base has revealed that it was originally marked with the bitten fruit motif. Objects marked with this motif are found across the cataclysm-era world, and their use is much debated. The uniformity of the motif suggests that it is a religious symbol, but it may also have been a glyph indicating that the object should be used for serving food. The different sizes may have been used for different meals. The bitten fruit artifact is, as is common, constructed partially of metal and partially of glass. Unusually for objects of this type, the glass is unbroken, giving it high value in the post-cataclysm years. It's speculated that the bitten fruit artifact was given as a tribute to the cult of the priestess queen and used to increase the majesty of her statue. The two objects were welded together around 2,500 years ago. Audio guide for the Museum of Post-Cataclysm Artifacts. The second object in this case is a stone head, neck, and one arm of a male figure. He is bearded, and his ears are pierced. His chest is decorated with pieces of glass. The display text reads, Statue of Serving Boy, found in the same hoard as the priestess queen. From the careful grooming and sensuous features, it has been speculated that this statue depicts a sex worker. The statue is decorated with cataclysm-era glass, whose composition is similar to that of the base of priestess queen. It almost certainly came from a broken bitten fruit artifact. The glass was probably added to this statue at the same time that the base was added to priestess queen.
One year. Invitation. The President and her government request the pleasure of the company of Senator Margot Cleary, Ms. Roxanne Monk, Mother Eve, and Mr. Tunde Edo at a reception and dinner on Wednesday evening, June the 15th, at 7 o'clock.
Margot. Can you comment on why you're here, Senator Cleary?
President Maskelev has been ousted in a military coup from the country of which he was the leader, chosen by a democratic process, Tunde. This is the kind of thing which the government of the United States takes very seriously. And may I say how delighted I am that you are engaging the younger generation in this sort of important geopolitical issue.
It's the younger generation who will have to live in the world you're building, Senator.
You're right. And that's why I'm so thrilled that my daughter, Jocelyn, is visiting the country with me as part of the United Nations delegation.
Can you comment on the recent defeat of the forces of the Republic of Besepara by the troops of North Moldova?
It's a party, son, not a defense strategy meeting.
You know, Senator Cleary, you sit on, is it 5 strategic committees now? He counts them off on his fingers. Defense, foreign relations, homeland security, budget, and intelligence. You're quite the powerhouse to be sent to a party.
You've done your homework.
I have, Mum.
The North Moldovans are funded by the House of Saud in Exile, aren't they? Is this war with Besapara a proving ground for an attempt to retake Saudi Arabia?
The Saudi Arabian government was democratically elected by their people. The United States government supports democracy around the world and peaceful regime change.
Is the United States government here to secure the oil pipeline?
There is no oil in Moldova or Besapara, Tunde. But another regime change in Saudi Arabia might affect your oil supply, don't you think?
That can't be a concern when we're talking about the freedom of a democracy.
He almost laughs. A little smirk peels across his face and disappears.
Okay, says Tunde. Fine. The United States would rather promote democracy than oil. Okay.
And what message does your attending this party tonight send about domestic terrorism back home?
Let me be clear, says Margot, staring straight into Tunde's camera with a clear, level gaze.
The United States government is not afraid of domestic terrorists or the people who fund them.
And by the people who fund them, you mean King Awadi Atif of Saudi Arabia?
That's all I have to say on this.
And any comment on why you've been sent here, Senator? You in particular, with your connections to the North Star training camps for young women. Is that why you were chosen to come here?
Margot does a little chuckle that seems entirely sincere.
I'm just a little fish, Tunde. A minnow, really. I came because I was invited. And now I just want to enjoy the party. And I'm sure you do, too.
She turns away, walks a few paces to the right, waits until she hears the snap of his camera turning off.
Don't start coming after me, son, she says out of the corner of her mouth. I'm your friend here.
Tunde notices the word son. Says nothing. Holds it close to his chest. Is glad he left the audio recording running, even though the video is off.
I could have pushed you twice as hard, he says. Mom.
Margot squints at him.
I like you, Tunde, she says. You did good work on that interview with Urban Docs.
Those nuke threats really got Congress to sit up and take notice, voted us the money we need to defend the country.
You still in touch with his people?
Sometimes.
You hear they got anything big coming down the pipe? You come and tell me, all right?
I'll make it worth your while. There's money in it now.
A lot of money.
You might make a great press consultant with our training camps.
Uh-huh, says Tunde. I'll let you know.
Be sure you do. She smiles reassuringly. At least, that's what she intends.
She has the feeling that once it reaches her lips, it might have come out more as a leer. The problem is that these fucking reporters are so attractive. She's seen Tunde's videos before. Maddie is a huge fan. And he's actually making a difference with the 18 to 35 voting demographic. It's amazing how, amongst all the talk about his relaxed and accessible style, no one mentions that Olatunde Edo's videos have become such a hit because he's handsome as hell. He's half naked in some of them, reporting from the beach in just speedos. And how's she supposed to take him seriously now when she's seen his broad shoulders and narrow waist and the rolling landscape of his obliques and delts, glutes and pecs of his firm... Shit. She really needs to get laid. Christ, okay. There are a few young guys among the staff on this trip. She'll buy one of them a drink after the party because this can't be happening in her mind every time she's confronted with a handsome reporter. She grabs a schnapps from a passing tray, downs it. An aide catches her eye across the room, points to her wristwatch. We're off to the races. You've got to admit, she whispers to Francis, her aide, as they climb the marble stairs. They know how to pick a castle. The place looks like it's been transported brick by brick from Disney. Gilt furniture. 7 pointed spires, each a different shape and size. Some fluted, some smooth, some tipped with gold. Pine forest in the foreground, mountains in the distance. Yeah, yeah, you've got history and culture. Yeah, yeah, you're not no one. Fine. Tatiana Moskalev is, no kidding, sitting on an actual throne when Margot walks in. A huge gold thing, with lions' heads on the arms and a red velvet cushion. Margot manages not to smile. The president of Besapara is wearing an enormous white fur coat with a gold dress underneath. She has a ring on each finger and 2 on each thumb. It's like she's learned what a president ought to look like from watching too many mafia movies. Maybe that's what she did. The door closes behind Margot. They're alone together. President Moskalev, says Margot, an honor to meet you. Senator Cleary, says Tatiana, the honor is mine. The snake meets the tiger, Margot thinks. The jackal greets the scorpion. Please, says Tatiana, take a glass of our ice wine, the finest in Europe, the product of our Besaparan vineyards. Margot sips it, wondering how likely it is to be poisoned. She puts the odds at no more than 3%. It'd look very bad for them if she died here. The wine is excellent, says Margot. I would have expected no less. Tatiana smiles a thin and distant smile. You like Besapara? She says. You have enjoyed the tours, music, dancing, local cheese. Margot had sat through a 3-hour demonstration and talk on local cheesemaking practices that morning. 3 hours. On cheese. Oh, your country is delightful, Madam President. Such old-world charm, combined with such focus and determination to move into the future together. Yes, Tatiana smiles thinly again. We think we are maybe the most forward-thinking country in the world, you know. Ah, yes. I am looking forward to the visit to your science technology park tomorrow. Tatiana shakes her head. Culturally, she says, socially. We are the only country in the world to really understand what this change means. To understand it as a blessing. An invitation to... She shakes her head for a moment, as if to clear a kind of fog. An invitation to a new way of living. Margot says nothing, and sips her wine again, making an appreciative face. I like America, says Tatiana. My late husband, Victor, liked USSR, but I like America. Land of freedom, land of opportunity, good music, better than Russian music. She starts to sing the lyrics to a pop song Maddie's been playing around the house incessantly. When we drive you so fast, in your car, oh boom boom. Her voice is pleasant. Margot remembers reading somewhere that Tatiana had ambitions to be a pop star, once upon a time.
You want us to get them to come play here? They tour. We can fix it up.
Tatiana says,
I think you know what I want. I think you know. Senator Cleary, you are not a stupid woman.
Margot smiles. I may not be stupid, but I'm not a mind reader, President Maskelev.
All we want, says Tatiana, is American dream, right here in Bezpara. We are a new nation, lucky little state, bordered by a terrible enemy. We want to live freely, to pursue our own way of life. We want opportunity. That's all.
Margot nods. That's what everyone wants, Madam President. Democracy for all is America's fondest wish for the world. Tatiana's lips turn faintly upward.
Then you will help us against the North.
Margot chews her top lip for a moment. This is a tricky point. She'd known it was coming.
I've had conversations with the president. While we support your independence, as it is the will of your people, we can't be seen to interfere in a war between North Moldova and Bezpara. You and I are more subtle than this, Senator Cleary. We can offer humanitarian aid and peacekeeping forces. You can vote against any action against us in the UN Security Council.
Margot frowns. But there are no actions against you in the UN Security Council. Tatiana places her glass very deliberately on the table in front of her.
Senator Cleary, my country has been betrayed by some of its men. We know this. We were defeated in the recent Battle of the Dniester because the North knew where our troops would be. Men from Bezpara have sold information to our enemies in the North. Some of them have been found. Some of them have confessed. We need to take action.
That is your prerogative, of course.
You will not interfere in this action. You will support whatever we do.
Margot gives a little chuckle.
I'm not sure I can promise anything that sweeping, Madam President.
Tatiana turns around, leans back against the window pane. She is silhouetted against the brightly lit Disney castle behind her.
You work with North Star, don't you? Private military? You are a shareholder, in fact. I like North Star. Teaching girls to be warriors. Very good. We need it more.
Well, this wasn't what Margot was expecting, but it's intriguing.
I don't quite see how these things are linked, Madam President, she says,
although she's beginning to have a shrewd idea.
North Star wants the UN mandate to send its own North Star-trained female troops into Saudi Arabia. The government in Saudi Arabia is crumbling. The state is unstable.
If the UN approves the deployment, I think it'll be good news for the world, yes. Securing the supply of energy, helping the government through a difficult period of transition.
It would be easier to make the case, says Tatiana, if another government had already successfully deployed North Star forces.
Tatiana pauses, pours herself another glass of the ice wine, pours one for Margot, too. They both know where this is going. Their eyes meet. Margot is smiling.
You want to employ North Star girls yourself? Here's my private army, here and on the border.
It's worth a lot of money. Even more if they win the war with the North and seize the Saudi assets. Acting as a private army here would take North Star exactly where they want to go. The board would be very happy to continue their association with Margot Cleary until the end of time, if she could pull this off.
And in exchange you want? We are going to alter our laws a little during this time of trouble to prevent more traitors giving away our secrets to the North. We want you to stand by us.
We have no wish to interfere in the affairs of a sovereign nation, says Margot,
Cultural differences must be respected. I know the president will trust my judgment on this.
Good, says Tatiana, and makes a slow, green-eyed blink.
Then, we understand each other.
She pauses.
We don't have to ask ourselves what the North would do if they won, Senator Cleary. We've already seen what they do. We all remember what Saudi Arabia was. We are both on the right side here.
She raises her glass. Margot tips her slowly until it just touches Tatiana's glass with a gentle chink. It's a great day for America. A great day for the world. The rest of the party is precisely as dull as Margot had expected. She shakes hands with foreign dignitaries and religious leaders and people she suspects to be criminals and arms dealers. She mouths the same lines over and over again about the United States' deep sympathy with victims of injustice and tyranny and their wish to see a peaceful resolution to the situation here in this troubled region. There's some kerfuffle at the reception just after Tatiana makes her entrance, but Margot doesn't see it. She stays until 10:30 p.m., the officially designated time that is neither too early nor too late to leave a significant party. On her way down to the diplomatic car, she bumps into the reporter Tunde again. "Excuse me," he says, dropping something onto the floor and immediately retrieving it, too fast for her to see.
"I mean, excuse me. I'm sorry, I'm in a hurry."
She laughs. She's had a good night. She's already calculating the kind of bonus she'll get from North Star if this all works out, and thinking about super PAC contributions for the next election cycle.
"Why hurry?" she says. "There's no need to rush away. Want a ride?"
She gestures to the car, its door open, its buttery leather interior inviting. He conceals his momentary look of panic with a smile, but not quite quickly enough.
"Another time," he says.
His loss. Later, in the hotel, she buys a couple of drinks for one of the junior guys from the American Embassy in the Ukraine. He's attentive. Well, why wouldn't he be? She's going places. She rests her hand on his firm young ass as they ride the elevator together up to her suite. Alley. The castle's chapel has been remade. The glass and gold chandelier still floats in the center of the room, the wires holding it up too thin to be seen by candlelight. All these electric miracles. The windows depicting the angels praising Our Lady have remained intact, as have the panels to St. Teresa and St. Jerome. The others, and the enameled paintings in the cupola, have been replaced and reimagined according to the new scripture. There is the Almighty speaking to the matriarch Rebecca in the form of a dove. There is the prophet Deborah proclaiming the holy word to the disbelieving people. There, although she protested, is Mother Eve, the symbolic tree behind her, receiving the message from the heavens and extending her hand filled with lightning. In the center of the cupola is the hand with the all-seeing eye at its heart. That is the symbol of God, who watches over each of us, and whose mighty hand is outstretched to both the powerful and the enslaved. There is a soldier waiting for her in the chapel, a young woman who had requested a private audience. American, pretty, with light grey eyes and freckles across her cheeks.
"Are you waiting to see me?" says Mother Eve.
"Yes," says Jocelyn, daughter of Senator Cleary, who sits on 5 key committees, including defense and budget. Mother Eve has made time for this private meeting.
"It is good to meet you, daughter."
She comes to sit beside her.
"How can I help you?"
And Jocelyn starts to cry.
"My mother would kill me if she knew I was here," she says. "She'd kill me. Oh, mother, I don't know what to do."
"Have you come for guidance?"
Ali had looked at the request for an audience with interest. That the senator's daughter should be here was no great surprise. That she would want to see Mother Eve in the flesh made sense. But a private audience? Ali had wondered whether she'd be a skeptic, looking to have an argument about the existence of God, but apparently not.
"I'm so lost,"
says Jocelyn through her tears.
"I don't know who I am anymore. I watch your talks and I keep waiting for her. I ask your voice to guide me and tell me what to do."
Ali is quite familiar with trouble that is too deep to be spoken. She knows it happens in any house, however high. There is no place that cannot be penetrated by the kind of trouble Ali has seen in her life. She extends a hand,